let me begin by saying hi to all of our Atlanta area churches, our strategic partners, and if you're watching on television or if you're watching at home online, we're so glad that you're here. We're in the fourth part of a series called Christian, and if you're coming into the middle of the series, we'll try to catch you up real quick. We're going to extend this for the next few weeks, and I just want to tell you, our next installment number five of Christian, we're going to a whole new level. So if you've been offended a little bit, just hang on. Or if you've been bored, come on back because it's about to get really exciting. But as we kind of finish this first phase, I want to kind of catch you up a little bit and then take you forward a little bit. What we've been talking about is the fact that Jesus never referred to his followers as Christians. Never once. He called us something else. He gave them several brands. He gave them word pictures, but he never called his followers Christians. That came much, much, much later. And unfortunately, we have settled for Christian. And the reason it's easy to settle for Christian is you can make a Christian anything you want to because it's not defined in the scriptures. It's only used three times. And it was used as a term that outsiders used to describe the followers of Jesus. But Jesus used different terminology. Jesus actually gave his followers a brand or a label, and they took that brand and that label so seriously. Take a look at what they did. When you visit Rome today, the city of Rome, on just about the top of just about every single building, everywhere in the city of Rome, in modern Rome, you find crosses, crosses. Everywhere you look, there are crosses. There are even crosses in the emperor's gate and the slave gate of the Roman Colosseum. Everywhere you go in the city of Rome, there are crosses. Now, before you fast forward too quick through history and say, yeah, well, the Pope lives there, I think you have to do that. I just want you to think back with me for just a second. And if we could get our arms around this, this is a staggering thought. And if you're not a religious person or not a Christian or not a church person, here's a little mystery of history that you ought to think about. If we could go back in time to about 64, 65 AD, Nero has just burned the city of Rome. He needs a scapegoat. He decides he's going to blame it on this new Jewish knockoff cult from, you know, Palestine that called the Christians. So he announces that the Christians burned the city of Rome. He sends his henchmen and his road warriors all throughout the city, rounding up all the Christians to burn them. And he has a thing called Nero's Circus. It wasn't really a circus. It was basically an arena. So he's burning Christians, feeding Christians to lions, making sport out of it, persecuting the Christians. And imagine for just a minute, we can go back in time to about 64, 65 AD. When all of this is going on, we go outside the city of Rome, we visit a farm, behind the farmhouse is a barn, and in the back of the barn huddles three Christian families that have fled the city of Rome. They know they'll never be able to go back to the city, they've lost everything they have, and if anyone finds out that they're a Christian, there's a bounty on their head, they will be paid to bring them into the city, introduce them to Nero, and they would again be persecuted and eventually put to death. And we sit down on the straw with these three frightened families, their children crying, the men scared to death, they don't know what to do, and we ask them this, or we say this: did you know that in a matter of time, over a period of time, one day the city of Rome will be adorned everywhere with crosses? And these crosses won't be wooden crosses. These crosses will be affixed to every single thing imaginable, from buildings to walls to highways to signs, they'll be everywhere. And these crosses will not represent Rome. These crosses won't even represent crucifixion. These crosses will represent one single crucifixion of one Jewish carpenter, the very man that you worship, Jesus Christ, your Lord. And one day, this movement that you're a part of is going to become so broad and has become internationally known that one day, this, the very city that you fled from, where Nero lives, at the epicenter of the persecution, one day there will be more crosses representing and in memory of Jesus Christ your Lord than any other city in the world. One day all those temples in the city that you fled, they will be tourist attractions. The day is coming, no one will worship Jupiter. The day will come when Christians will make pilgrimages to Rome to visit where Nero's circus currently is, where your brothers and sisters are being put to death. But instead of a circus, instead of an arena, there will be a cathedral built in memory of Peter, the fisherman, who will become the leader of this movement that you call the Way, that one day will become known as Christianity. Can you imagine what would run through their minds? They would look at you like you're a fool. They would look at you like you're crazy. They would say, no, Rome is forever. Jupiter is forever. Yes, we believe in Jesus the Messiah. We believe in Jesus the carpenter. We believe he's the Savior. But his movement is a small movement. We're only one of us, you know, several dozen. And there's no way in the world that Rome would ever turn upside down and surrender to this new fledgling movement that we call the way. And yet, within 300 years, which historically speaking is not a long time, within 300 years, there are crosses everywhere, everywhere, everywhere. How did that happen? Let me tell you how it didn't happen. It didn't happen because the Jesus followers decided to be Christians. It happened because the Jesus followers decided not to lower themselves to simply be Christians. It happened because the followers of Jesus embraced the teachings of Jesus at such a significant level that they took seriously the labels that he gave them. They took seriously the brand that he gave them. And over time, you can't argue with this, over time, they changed the world. So what are you doing? What am I doing? And why would we settle for Christian? Why would we settle for Christian, which we can't even define, when Jesus gives us such specific instructions? So today, in our fourth installment of this series, Christian, I want to read the speech that got it all going, okay? This was the speech that everybody rallied around. This was the beginning of the movement. And this was early on in Jesus' ministry. And you've heard these words before. But I want to kind of pitch it in a different context. Hundreds, maybe thousands of people have gathered. And Jesus realizes this is the moment to lay the groundwork. This is the moment to lay the foundation. This is the beginning of the movement. This is the beginning of the change. I'm going to introduce to this group of people the value system and the worldview and the habits and the behaviors that are going to turn the world upside down. You ready for the revolutionary speech that changed everything? It's the reason you're here today and the reason I'm here today. Matthew chapter 5. Here's where it all began. Now, when Jesus saw the crowds, Matthew 5 verse 1, he went up on a mountainside. That's why we call this the Sermon on the Mount. And he sat down. And his disciples, because that's what he called his followers, his disciples came to him and he began to teach them. And now I'm going to give you the revolutionary, world-changing, shut down the Roman Empire speech that Jesus gave. Verse 3. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. There you go. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Then it gets stronger. Blessed are those who mourn, for they'll be comforted. Really? That's all you got? No, there's more. Blessed are the meek. Blessed are the gentle. Blessed are the humble. Blessed are the considerate. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Jesus, can I interrupt you there? I got a quick question. Meek? Really? Are you from around here? Do you know what's going on in the world? Meek? Do you know anything about Rome? Do you know that we haven't had our freedom in dozens and dozens and dozens of years? Do you know where meekness has gotten us? Do you know where meekness will get us? Blessed are the meek. They're going to inherit the earth. No, we can't even control our own land. We can't even control our own nation. Meek? Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled with what? Righteousness. Blessed are the merciful. Now that'll get them. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Okay, I got another quick question. Peacemakers? Do you really think we're going to be able to retake our world and retake our land, retake our nation through peacemaking? Do you know what happens to people who make peace with the Roman Empire? They're swallowed up. They evaporate. They're consumed. They just become one more of the tax-paying horde. Peacemaking? Matthew, are you writing this down? Matthew's like, I'm not even sure this is worth writing down. Where is this going? What have we signed up for? Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when people insult you and persecute you falsely and say all kinds of evil things against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven, for in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you. Yeah, it was, you know, I think the crowd was just like this. It was like, you know, maybe he'll do a miracle because this speech isn't going anywhere. Really? This is the start of something new? So Jesus, before you go on, let me see if I can review. Let me do a quick review. So we're poor, sad, meek, righteous, merciful, pure, peaceful, persecuted, insulted people waiting for a reward in heaven. Is that who we are? Is that it? Poor, sad, meek, righteous, merciful, pure, peaceful, persecuted, insulted people waiting for a reward in heaven? And you think this is going somewhere? To which maybe Jesus chuckled, maybe Jesus smiled. We don't know what of the future Jesus knew. But I'll tell you what happened. 300 years later, the message of Jesus is everywhere. Nobody's worshiping Jupiter anymore. So Jesus backs up and realizes, now, nah, don't worry about that. You can't remember all that stuff anyway. Let me give you two word pictures to tell you who you are. Yeah, you're all of this, but let me put it in practical terms. His next phrase was this: you are the salt of the earth. That's who you are. You're the salt of the earth. Now, everybody in Jesus' audience knew what salt was. Salt was a preservative. Of course, they didn't have refrigeration, right? So salt was a preservative. And for those of you who don't know, a preservative is simply this. It's a substance, salt, added to food. Well, you need to learn something in church, so here we go. Okay, this may be the only helpful information for the whole day, so pay attention, all right? A substance added to food to prevent decomposition. Because see, when there's no preservative, things decompose. When there's no preservative, things rot. When there's no concern, when there's no preservation, no preservative, things stink. It's a substance added to food to prevent decomposition due to chemical change or bacterial action. So here's what Jesus was saying to his audience, and here's what he's saying to us today. You are the preservative of the entire earth. You are the preserve. If you don't preserve, the earth rots. If you don't preserve, culture stinks. If you don't preserve, things go in a very, very, very negative way. And imagine the world he was speaking into. He was speaking into a world where might made right. If you wanted to know what the right thing to do was, you look for the people with the biggest army. That's how right was determined. Moral issues weren't really moral issues. Ethical issues weren't really ethical issues. It was who has the longest sword, who has the most might. Women had no rights. Children had fewer rights. Mercy, compassion, generosity were not virtues. Those were things for the weak. It was a world we can't imagine. The only way you can imagine it is to visit some other countries in our world that still operate by that worldview. What we can't fully appreciate in the Western world, what we certainly can't fully appreciate as Americans, is this: that much of what we assume is common human decency, what we assume is common courtesy, is not common. It was learned. That we still reflect the Judeo-Christian ethic that goes deep into our culture. What we consider as typically how Americans are is not how Americans are. It's how Americans learned to be. That we still reflect these fundamental issues that Jesus taught that eventually went all the way around the world and transformed cultures everywhere. Because we can't imagine that women would be treated any less than a man. And obviously there were times in this country when that was the case, and yet there was something that we knew intuitively was wrong with that, and we fixed it. And intuitively we know that a person should never have ownership of another person. There's just something wrong about that. And eventually our national conscience caught up with the reality of that teaching. Isn't that true? And we know that children are precious, but why do we think children are precious when in other cultures children aren't precious at all? Why do we think that when someone is generous and they give of their extra to help those in need, why do we say that is good instead of weak? Why do we think compassion is good instead of weak? Why do we applaud mercy? Why do we stop and applaud the person that risked their life or risked their income for the sake of those in need? Why do we think that's good? It's not human nature. It's not common human decency. It's the reflection of a worldview that says there is one single God, And that eventually you will give an account for your life to that one single God. And that God loves everyone you are ever eyeball to eyeball with. Red, yellow, black, and white. They are all precious in his sight. Male, female, children. That there's an underlying belief system that came ultimately from ancient Judaism that then was expounded and exploded through the teachings of Jesus. And the first century Christians, the first century disciples, the first century brothers and sisters, they grabbed onto that and they believed it. And Jesus said, look, you have no standing, but you are the last stand. You have no political standing. You have no financial standing. You have no, you know, you don't have a grip. Nobody's paying attention. But you, he said to that crowd gathered that day, you're the last stand. And if you aren't the salt of the earth rots. And if you think it's bad now, you give up. You go with the current. And you'll see how bad things really can get. We can't fully appreciate this, but we benefit every single day from a worldview that says men and women and children have value, that men, women, and children are somehow made in the image of God. And that is not intuitive. Let's face it. We hear about human trafficking. We hear about slavery in other countries. We hear about the way children are trafficked. And we think, how could anyone treat someone that way? It's very simple. They do not see the world the way that you see it. And the reason they don't see the world the way that you see it is because you have been taught to see the world the way that you do. And it was when Jesus knelt and he said, I want to teach you how to pray. And he says, when you pray, you say, our Father. And all of a sudden, God becomes a God with a personality. And all of a sudden, God is no longer Jupiter. Suddenly, God is no longer the pantheon of gods that just played with humans. But somehow through Jesus, we learn that God actually loves us. And if he loves you, he loves me. And if he loves me, he loves you. And suddenly I have value and I have worth. And I better be careful how I treat you. And you better be careful how you treat me. And so when Jesus gathered with his disciples and said, by this one thing, by this one thing, by this one thing, all people will know that you're my follower, how you love, how you treat, how you appreciate, how you care for one another. And Jesus said, that's new and that's different. And if you'll allow it to, it's going to take hold. You are the salt, the preservers of the earth. And he said this, not only that, you're the light of the world. To which we say, I don't want to be the light of the world. I just want to be a Christian and go to heaven when I die. Leave me alone, okay? I don't want to be a light and a salt. I prayed that magic prayer. Now I just want to go back and raise my family and go to heaven when I die. Jesus said, no, I don't know who taught you that. You're the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world. You know what's so strange about this? Do you know how big the world was to that group of people gathered that day? It was small. No one traveled more than about 15 miles from home. They didn't even know about North and South America. There were continents that hadn't even been discovered. There are continents that they didn't know about that now have churches on them because he was serious. You are the light of a world you don't even know anything about. A town, he said, or a city placed on a hill. And the English version of the Bible has the word built, but the translators that, you know, translated this in Greek didn't use the word built. They used a little Greek word that's more like placed because it was intentional. A town placed on a hill cannot be hidden. And if you've been to that part of the world, you know it's flat, it's hilly, there are no trees, there are only shrubs, and they built towns on hills. And they built them out of white limestone, and you can see them for miles and miles and miles. The sun reflects off of them. At night, they light their oil lamps, and the you can see for miles and miles around. And Jesus said, just as a city on a hill, just as a town on a hill cannot be hidden. That's what you are. You are like a strategically placed city. You're like a strategically placed town. That's why you're the light of the world. You've been strategically placed. To which we say, no, I'm not strategically placed, okay? I was transferred here from Orlando, and I didn't really want to come. And once I got here, I lost my job anyway. Now I'm stuck in this stupid city. I'm not a strategically placed. I'm like a misfit trying to get back home. Jesus said, no. It may seem random to you. You are a strategically placed light on hill. No, I'm not. See, I was dating this guy in New York and he said, let's move down south. We moved down south. Then he dumped me for his boss. Good grief. And now I'm stuck and I don't even want to be here. My family's, I'm not strategic. I'm just trying to save up enough money to move back home. Jesus said, no, if you're my follower, It may seem random to you. You are strategically. No, I'm not strategically placed. See, I wanted to get in fraternity A. I didn't make A. I didn't make B. I'm in fraternity C. I don't even want to be part of this group. But my dad said, you go to be in a fraternity, you never get a job. So now I'm in this dumb fraternity I don't want to be in. I'm not a strategically placed light on a hill. I'm stuck with a bunch of guys I don't even like. Jesus said, if you're my follower, you're light. You have been strategically placed where you are. He said this, neither do people light a lamp, put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on a stand, and it gives light to everyone in the house. In the same way as a city placed on a hill, in the same way as a light placed on a stand, in the same way as a city built and put on a hill, in the same way as a light placed on a stand, let your light shine before others. And then here's how we read the next part. That they may see your church attendance and say, dang, he's a good Christian. I go to church. I'm going to heaven. Leave me alone. I don't want to be a light. I don't want to be salt. I just want to be a Christian because I don't even know what that is, except my mama told me, you know. That's how we read this. Listen to what Jesus said to this group of people who never went anywhere and didn't have anything. Here's what he said. In the same way, let your light shine before others that they may see your good deeds and give glory or glorify your Father in heaven. You know, this is so powerful. You know what he's saying? He's saying, I want you to live your life in such a way that when people see your good deeds, they don't go, oh, you know, he's a nice guy. Oh, shoot, they're so nice. They see your good deeds and go, are you kidding? Who's that generous? Who is that nice? They keep bringing us food. I mean, I got sick and we hardly even know them. They keep bringing us meals. They take in those children. I mean, they're busy people and still they're taking in children. These are like the nicest people I know. They're like church people, which scares me, but good grief, what is up? They are the kindest, most generous. I mean, he can't do enough for you. I mean, he bailed me out time after time after time. I mean, I work for this guy and I know he's like a Christian, which kind of freaks me out. And I messed up at work and I thought he was going to call me in and fire me. And he sits me down and says, you know, you really screwed up and you cost this company a lot of money, but I want you to know something. I know this is kind of weird, but as you know, I'm a Christian. And I believe in second chances. I'm giving you a second chance. And I walked out of that office and I thought, whoo, I don't know about the Christian part, but he should have fired me. I don't know what's up with him. I don't know what's up. Jesus said, I want your good deeds to be extraordinary. I want them to be so extraordinary that people begin to connect the dots between your lifestyle and your Father in heaven. I want you to be a dot connector. I want your light to shine so bright that it outshines everybody else to make people go, what's up with you? And when it's appropriate, you connect the dots for them so that they begin to give credit, not to you for your good deeds, but your Father in heaven. Whoo! Some of you are great at this. Some of you are great at this. Some of you, you're just happy to be going to heaven when you die. Hopefully you're a Christian. And Jesus said, I never called you Christian. I'm telling you who you are. You're salt and you're light. You're salt and you're light. And you know what? You've heard me talk about this before. In the first century, those Christians, those followers of Jesus, they got after this. They went down to the river and took children that had been discarded and abandoned and took them into their homes, even though they already had their own children. When plagues broke out in the small towns and villages, everybody fled. The priest, the pagan priest, went first. Because they knew quickness about the plague because people brought their sick to the pagan priest and the pagan priest looked at the things breaking out and went, honey, pack, we are leaving. There's a plague in this town. And the Christians stayed and they nursed people they barely knew to the difficulty of a plague and they lost their lives. And people began to ask the question, what's up with these people? You know what else they noticed? These Jesus followers, they're not afraid to die. They are not afraid to die. They know something I don't know about what's on the other side. They're not afraid of death. And they lived their life in such a way that the pagan Roman Greek community began to connect the dots. And in a matter of just a few hundred years, the world turned upside down. Not because of good preaching, not because of good teaching, but because of powerful living. Men and women who took seriously the admonition to be salt and light, salt and light, salt and light. So Here's what I think Jesus would say to us today. Don't settle for Christian. What's that anyway? Be salt. Be light. Be just irritating enough to where people pay attention because you live a different kind of life. Every once in a while, you have to speak up and say, I don't know that's a great idea. Every once in a while, you have to take somebody to coffee and say, look, I know this is kind of not my idea, but I noticed this and I'm thinking maybe this. I just want to throw that out there. Be a preserver and be a light that through your lifestyle points the way. Now, you know, when I talk about stuff like this, you begin to filter it through your life and your where you work and your family and all that stuff. And I understand that. But let me turn it around, because the way to truly understand the significance of this is to think about your story. You see, the only reason, if you're a Christian or a Jesus follower or a disciple or whatever you want to call yourself, and now you're scared to say the word Christian, I realize. I'm sorry, I took that away from you. We'll get over this series and move on and get back to that, okay? So whatever you are, you know, it's like I'm a Bible person. I don't know what I am, okay? Here's the deal. If you're a Christian, if you're a follower of Jesus, here's what I know about you, though I've never heard your story. You are a follower of Jesus because somebody was salt and light in your life. And they didn't necessarily mean to be. In fact, they didn't even know they were being. And they didn't feel like they were some strategically placed, I'm a city on a hill at Nations Bank. They didn't think that. I'm a city on a hill at Lowe's or Home Depot. I'm a city on a hill at, you know, in the office. They weren't thinking that. They were just trying to be what they thought they should be, and you noticed. They weren't trying to be a city on a hill in the neighborhood. But you know what? You think about the fact that they bought the house next to you, and that house wouldn't sell for a long time. Next thing you know, you got these crazy church neighbors, you know? And it's like, oh, no, they're going to wreck the party. Hope nobody invites them to the home association party because that's going to be weird, you know? And then you got to know them. And now you're a follower of Jesus, and here's what you would say about them. You would say, you know what? I feel like it's providential. I feel like God put them next to us, but they didn't feel that way. That was just a house. They like, that's how this works. You see, some of you, you're so grateful for the man or the woman that God brought into your husband or wife's life because you prayed and prayed and prayed. And you said, God, my husband's not going to listen to me. Maybe he'll listen to somebody else. My wife won't listen to me. Maybe she'll listen to somebody else. And God answered your prayer and brought somebody else into their life to begin to help to reorient their faith and reorient them toward the things of God. And that person, whoever he or she is, they didn't think of themselves as a city on a hill, but that's exactly what they were. They didn't think of themselves as salt, but that's exactly what they were. Some of you are so grateful for the people that have influenced your children in a positive way. And if you were to sit down with those people, they don't think of themselves as strategically placed, but they were from your perspective, weren't they? You see those as providential relationships. God brought him along at just the right time. God brought her along just at the right time. God brought those neighbors into my life. God brought that individual. God brought that boss. I just feel like God put them in my life at just the right time. Why? Because from our perspective as receivers, it seems so providential. But those men and women weren't thinking that. They were just being salt. And they were just being light. And now you know your heavenly Father. And now you have assurance about your eternity. And now you see the world in maybe a completely different way. So, students, high school students, college students, you're the salt of your university. You're the light of your high school. And you say, oh, no, I'm not. I'm a freshman. I can't even find my locker on most days. I have no influence and nobody knows my name. Now, I want you to listen. If that was your thought, if it went through my mind, here's listen to what you need to understand. Salt always preserves. Light always shows the way. Salt works even when you can't see it working, and light works even when you don't know it's working. Salt always preserves. Light always shows the way. You say, well, Andy, you know, where I work, we can't really talk about religious things, and we don't, and so I don't think I can be salt. And light, salt always preserves. Light always shows the way. If you're in an office, no matter where you are, middle management, lower management, you're the receptionist, or you own the company. If you're a Jesus follower, Jesus would look at you today and say, okay, you're the salt of that environment. You are the light of that world. Let your good deeds shine in such a way that people begin to connect the dots between your extraordinary deeds and the fact that you are a follower of me. And when everybody else says it's okay and you know it's not okay, you don't do it, even if you're not the only one, because you're salt. And everybody else says, well, this is just the way our industry works, and just this is just the way business is done, but it rubs up against your follow Jesus ethics, then you just have to decide you're not doing it that way. And yeah, they may ostracize you and you may accidentally make them feel guilty. That's okay. That's what salt does. And salt always preserves. And you have no idea who's going to look back on that interaction and say, you know what? There was this guy in my office. There was this woman in my office. And I found out they were Christians and this is how they behaved. This is how they managed things. And I never forgot that. And I knew in my heart I wanted to be like that, but I never told them because I was too proud. I never told them because it was going to be too disruptive. I never told them, but never forgot them. See, wherever you are, Jesus says you're salt. Wherever you are, Jesus says be light. And salt always preserves. And light always points the way forward. A couple months ago, or actually a month and a half ago, had an opportunity to spend some time with a couple who was celebrating their 45th wedding anniversary. Now, whenever I'm around somebody who's that many years ahead, you know, I can speak authoritatively for the first 23, okay? But somebody that's 45, I'm like, tell me, what? And so I didn't know this couple at all. As I listened to their story, I was astounded. She had come from a very abusive background. Her father was in every way abusive. At 18, she just wanted to get out of the house, so she married the first guy that paid any attention to her. So at 18, she gets married. She's married for 5 years. It is a disaster. She gets pregnant. Her husband leaves her to move in with his girlfriend when he found out she was pregnant, okay? She has the baby. They get divorced. And by her own description, she was angry, negative, dark, walls everywhere. No one's going to hurt me again. I'm going to control everything from this point forward kind of woman. And she went into business just to, you know, protect herself. And she meets Dave. And Dave is a wonderful Christian man. And Dave had been praying, and I don't recommend this. I even told him, I said, that's weird. Dave was praying, he'd never been married, that God would bring the right woman into his life. And he wanted it to be a woman that he could help. And boy, did God answer his prayer. I'm like, wow, I believe in answered prayer. Just not sure I would have prayed that one, okay? So they get married, and it is a disaster sideways, okay? I mean, it's just terrible. And the first 9 years, I just sat there going, you guys have been married 45 years. The first 5 years would have put the average person under. And here was the dynamic of their relationship. She said, I was so unhappy, I wasn't about to let anybody else be happy. I was so uncomfortable around happy people, my goal was just to make them as unhappy as me because I knew I could never be as happy as them. And so in their marriage, he said, you know what? I just decided I was not going to be an unhappy person just because my wife was miserable. And the more happy he got and the more joy-filled he got, and these are his words, and the more peaceful he became, the more irritated she became, and she worked that much harder to bring him down because if she's not going to be happy, ain't nobody going to be happy. That was the dynamic of their marriage for 9 years. I just sat there going, you have got to be kidding. And she said, it would just make me so mad. And I said, now, I'm sure you never told him how his happiness and joy irritated you. She said, no, he was going to be the last person to know how God was using it just to expose my sin and expose my negativity and expose my wall. She said, every single day, he was a mirror of what I wasn't and a mirror of what I wanted to be. But he was the last person I would ever tell. You know why? Because salt always preserves and light always shines. So after 9 years, and I'm not trying to give marriage advice, it's just their story. After 9 years, she just broke. She just fell apart and gave up. And God did a wonderful, wonderful work in her life. And they've been married 45 years. And I thought, there it is. There's somebody that's like, I don't know if it's working or not. I don't know if it will ever work. I don't know if she will ever change. And he admitted, and he said, Andy, I got to the point where I just told her, I don't think I can do this anymore. You're wearing me down. You're wearing me down. He said, we're on the verge of divorce. He said, but I just had to be who God called me to be in spite of what she thought. And it was his joy. It was his peace. It was his salt. It was his light that eventually brought her to the end of herself. Now, here's what you don't know, and here's what I don't know. We have no idea who is around us that is on the verge of a breakthrough simply because of our salt and our light. And we may never know the end of their story. And we may never know how our interaction with them impacted them. But here's what you can rest assured of. Salt always preserves. And light always shines the way or points the way forward. So, let's don't settle for Christian. Let's be the salt of the earth. Let's be the light of the world. Let's not settle for Christian. Let's live out our Christian values in such a way that at times it might be a little bit irritating to people, but it'll be a reminder. Well, why don't you move in with him? Well, I just don't think that's the right thing to do. Well, what do you mean? Well, I just don't think that's the right thing to do for me. Well, why don't you do the deal? Well, because it would require full disclosure, and that's what I'd have to do, and it just gets complicated, and so I'm going to fully disclose. I know that's going to wreck the deal, but that's just irritating. Being salt is irritating. Being salt is a preservative. So let's preserve where we can, and let's point the way forward, not with just our good deeds, but with our, oh my gosh, can you believe it? Who would do that? Good deeds. Let's not settle for Christian because Jesus said, all right? Jesus said, you are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world. And here's what we know. When you're the salt and when you're the light, it has the potential to change everything. So let's not settle for Christian. Let's ask God how to make us more effective salt and more effective light. And as God answers that prayer, who knows what God might do in our families, in our communities, in our cities, in our country, come on, in the whole world. Let me pray for you. Father, I realize this is so much easier to stand up here and talk about than to walk out those doors and do. But by your grace and by your mercy, would you give each of us, even in this moment, just a glimpse of what that looks like at our school, what that looks like at work, what that looks like in our neighborhood, what that looks like on our tennis team, what that looks like as we coach Little League, what that looks like as we spend time with our families that don't really follow you, that don't really get it, that aren't really open, that don't really want to hear us talk about what we learned at church. Father, in this moment, would you give each of us just a glimpse, what would it look like to be a preservative in my community? What would it look like to be a light to my world? Give us the courage to do the unusual. Give us the courage to step out and to mimic those first century believers who, with no leverage, no organization, no money, no status, no recognition, lived in such a way that an empire was brought to its knees and eventually embraced the teachings of the Savior they crucified. God, it couldn't be any clearer. Just make it clear for each of us as we do our best by your grace and your mercy to be the salt of the whole earth and the light of the whole world. In Jesus' name, amen.